Marcia Fermerman and Jean Dickman entered 1975. But we just wanted to hear that.
Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Project, Roman Numeral 2. February 27, 1975, Marcia Fromerman and Jean Dickman interviewing Mrs. Maxine Aaron. Side 7. Mrs. Aaron, we would like to know your opinion on the elected versus the appointed school board system.
Well, I feel very strongly that the appointed school board produces a school board of higher quality and of more continuing concern. The elected school board has not been free of political pressure in any large system in this country, and in Pittsburgh it was particularly bad before 1911. I don't think the kind of people who by and large have served this board over the years would give the time necessary to run for election or to do the kind of thing they would have to do to become elected. And since the appointed board over the years has been composed largely of people with broad civic concerns, an elective board becomes subject to pressure, all kinds of pressures, and although theoretically it sounds right, it just hasn't worked. And before 1911, teachers were appointed by because they were friends of the board custodians and people all up and down the line. But apart from the political pressure and the integrity of the board, I don't think you would get the kind of broad-based representation that you would have, that you have today. And the representation of minority groups, women. And in addition, the question of continuity is very important. In our search for superintendents, I have found repeatedly that superintendents were leaving a community because of a complete change in the character of the board, which was undermining a program to which they had been committed and to which the board had been.
Could you tell me about your personal feeling on serving on the Pittsburgh School Board, what it has meant to you?
Well, it's been a great opportunity to do something that was significant, or at least I hope would be significant, that the quality of education pretty much determines the quality of the community. And this has been a period of a great deal of stress, a great deal of development of new ideas, so it's meant facing very fundamental problems, being right in the center of the social pressures of the time, and making whatever effort could be made to try to some extent to solve. From my own point of view, it came just at the time that I was finding it necessary to do something with my life because my children were growing up, and I was really seriously considering looking for some kind of part-time occupation. This came along just at the psychological moment, and sometimes it's been more than part-time.
Could you tell us what reaction your children and your husband had to your serving on the Pittsburgh School Board?
They were all very supportive and very enthusiastic. I think we're fully aware of the fact that I needed something to do, but also of the importance of what I was doing. And I've been most accommodating in adjusting to whatever gaps there were in my service to my family as a result. and were deeply interested in all the problems that came up. They were always ready to share in discussion and help my own thinking.
It would be of interest, I think, to people in the future to know approximately how many hours per day or per week you devoted to matters concerning our Pittsburgh schools.
Well, that's a very difficult question because it could vary anywhere from zero to maybe 30 or 40 hours. There would be a lot of meetings the next week, nothing, and that, of course, doesn't count the hours you spend mulling over problems. There are times when the things you're trying to face are with you day and night.
When you were thinking about a problem, were there any resources, such as the school Belfield Avenue Library, or was there a journal that school board members received so that you didn't feel completely alone?
There are lots of journals. There are too many journals. In fact, the struggle with the ever-present paper is a very serious one, but there are constant resources in the professional staff of the board, and people generally are willing to talk and discuss. I'm not sure that the nationally published material has been too valuable. Yes, it has. Much of it has been read. It certainly affects your thinking. But I think in many ways, Pittsburgh has been so far beyond other districts in its approach to many problems that what you get in the journals is fairly elementary. And on the other hand, you get many things like the publications of some of the foundations, like the Ford Foundation, which are on the cutting edge of new ideas, which very definitely influence your thinking.
Therefore, your time in matters concerning the school board was not limited just to attending the meeting. You, on your own, were doing a lot of reading.
Inevitably, it affects the way you read everything else. It affects the way you read the newspaper. The New York Times articles on education, what's happening elsewhere, they're all part of it.
Therefore, this did become your main focus and your main interest during the
years. Yes, very, very definitely. And I think sometimes to the exclusion of things that might have been broadening in other ways. I sometimes think I developed a one-track mind.
Could you talk, please, about your father-in-law's tenure on the school board and the little that you might know about that?
Well, he was a member of the board, of the original appointed board. He served from 1911 to 1947.
His full name was?
Marcus Aaron. And he was vice president from 1919 to 22 and president for 20 years. After that, and then served a number of years before his retirement.
What stories did you hear from him about his experiences on the school?
Well, he was deeply involved at the time that I came to Pittsburgh, and it was his major occupation. His business took far less of his time than the Board of Education. And he was in many ways responsible for the whole climate and the success of that board. He had been preceded by David B. Oliver as president, who was completely dedicated to the principles of an independent and professional school board. But in these 20 years, I think Marcus Aaron's major contributions were his insistence on the professional integrity and independence of staff. He saw very clearly where board responsibility ended and administrative response and professional responsibility began. But he was a fighter for teacher salaries, which he carried to the legislature and to the Chamber of Commerce and used the community for support. If he couldn't thought he was going to have trouble. He would appoint a citizens committee, for example, on teacher salaries, to marshal community support for increased teacher salaries, which of course usually meant higher taxes. A board in those days, under his leadership, insisted on a sound financial policy, not only the integrity of its financial processes, but the sound planning. A very conservative policy as to what you, the things for which you use bond money, as against current budget funds. And that has persisted to this day. There are periodic noises for something less in terms of cautious financial policy. But it's always paid off, and every time we float a bond issue, we see the benefit of it, because our bond bids come in lower than they would if we had a poorer financial rating. And in addition to which, he had a very broad social outlook. He was very aware of the importance of schools for the health and stability of a community. And he minced no words when he spoke to community groups about it. Particularly during the Depression years, when there was he got into a rousing a fight with the politicians who were fighting for decreased taxes, and they got a little. And they wanted to cut the teachers' salaries, and he fought tooth and nail with everybody on the importance of the schools at that time particularly. Also succeeded in making extensive use of federal money during the Depression to build schools. A lot of our good school buildings that are still functioning well today were built during those years.
What did your father-in-law think about your going on to the school board?
I think he was glad to see me do it. He made some remark on whether I, when it first came up, what would I want for that blankety-blank job. But fundamentally, I think he was pleased. And for the first few years on the board, I could share problems with him. And I think he had a very strong effect on me in the fact that I realized very early that you couldn't accomplish much there unless you were ready to fight for it. I had seen him functioning, and after keeping very quiet for a few months while I learned, I soon discovered that you had to come up and battle if you really cared about things. Not alone, there were allies in the board, but you had to find them and pull together.
But you would say that he was supportive of your serving on the
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Would you talk to us about how you feel the Pittsburgh Jewish community and its relation to the general community, how you view those two factors?
Well, I think fundamentally the relations are good. I think they're more relaxed than they used to be, and freer than they used to be. I think much of the, for years, there's been excellent communication between the rabbis of Rod of Shalom and the Christian ministers. And Goldenson and Dr. Van Etten of Calvary Church exchange pulpits periodically. Dr. Jacob now teaches at a course at Western Theological Seminary. I think much of the division perhaps has come on the club and social level, which to me has never been terribly important. It's never bothered me that we can't belong to the Duquesne Club or the 20th Century Club. On the other hand, I don't think clubs are a fundamental human right, and I don't go so far as to boycott a meeting of a group to which I belong because the hostess of the day happens to call it at a club at which I am not welcome.
When you think back of your first years here in Pittsburgh, would you say that there has been much change in how the Jewish community and the general community get along together?
I think there is a general easing of relationships. Didn't bother me. There's more mingling. There's the more cross representation on boards. I think socially there's perhaps less than there is in some other communities, but I've never worried myself too much about that whole aspect of it. I've had, through the board and other ways, plenty of contact. I do think that the Hitler years did broaden the outlook of the liberal Christian community. Things they just never thought about, never bothered about. They weren't prejudiced, they just didn't think about. And that pricked their consciences and made them feel that this was a responsibility.
While we're talking about comparisons, I wonder if you would tell us about Road of Sholem of the day, beginning days of your coming to Pittsburgh, and how you view the changes that are going on and what you see now.
Of course, you have to remember that I have had no religious upbringing in New York. I came to Road of Sholem, which was the center of the life of the Jewish community, to a family that had been deeply involved in the congregation. Dr. Goldenson was the rabbi at that time, and his stress on the universal aspects of religion, the moral challenge in religion, the centrality of the prophets in his whole approach to religion, made it far easier for me, I think, than it would have been later. Now, fundamentally, much of this is true, but still true. But there is today more Hebrew in the service. There's more of a concern with what people choose to call Jewish identity, which expresses itself through a return to old customs, of which Hebrew, the increased use of Hebrew, is a part. And that I do not find particularly compatible with my way of thinking. I think you can maintain your loyalty to Jewish values and your integrity as a Jew, without putting all this stress on cultural difference. I think you can have your... I see it essentially as a religious question, and the place to which you look for moral and spiritual guidance, to whatever degree it fits your own personal needs. I don't think you have to keep trying to see how different you can make yourself. Neither do you have to give up your own characteristics.
Could you talk to us about your views on Jewish survival?
I don't know that I've given too much thought to it. To me, it's what is going to make Jewish survival possible is
and it adheres to its main sources of moral and ethical inspiration. I know a lot of people worry about intermarriage. It exists, and some of it is going to continue to exist as we broaden our contacts in the world, inevitably. But if the main thrust of our religious message is real and is related to the world in which we live, and I don't mean relevance in its current trivial sense, the Jews will survive. I don't think you have to adopt every musical and cultural fad in your religious pattern. I do think you have to turn to your religion for the inspiration to solve the social and ethical problems around you.
Could we turn for a few minutes to have you describe your recreational life?
Well, our recreational life is reading, music. We enjoy concerts that neither of us can perform in any way. Has largely been outdoor activity, walking, skating, tennis, and taking to the mountains in the summertime, year in and year out. Not had fancy climbing, but we just love the mountains, the hike, enjoy the scenery, and the kind of people whom we meet in the mountains. And we've happily shared that experience over the years with children and grandchildren. I think that's one of the great things about that form of recreation, is that it does span generations. It goes back to my husband's parents enjoyed the mountains with us, enjoyed the outdoors as a child with my parents.
So that when you married and came to Pittsburgh, that was not something new to you. You had already been doing that as a child and as a young woman.
Yes, not in a different way. I think more of it was centered around tennis and swimming, and less actually mountain days. But we always have.
And these sports that you have mentioned to us, they are not a thing of the past. They are still very much a part of your life and your husband's.
Very much so. Perhaps a little reduced in quantity, but still there.
So you're still playing tennis, you're still walking.
Still skating.
Skating.
Still hiking, a little less mileage, a little less altitude, but still at it. I'm not too proud to let a grandchild carry some of my knapsack.
Aw. I wonder if you could tell us your views on integration, how far you think we've come and where you see us going.
I think we've come a long way. I think we have a very long way to go. It seems to me that integration, as far as schools are concerned, we must make exposure to people of another race a part of every child's education somehow. We have got to raise children, a generation that hates less. But whether we can do it by a purely numerical balance, I don't know. It seems to me that there's great danger that we start treating people as statistics instead of people, and also that we reach a point where, in order to safeguard some rights, we impinge on others. For example, how are you going to maintain integration in a city if people just keep on moving out? But you can't say to people, you may not move. That gets to something very fundamental. But when we start talking about neighborhood schools, the word neighborhood is a very elastic word. is it five blocks or is it a mile? And I think there are techniques that can be pursued that we haven't developed yet. I think there's a great deal more to be done, but I think perhaps the best way to put it is that integration, from a school's point of view, is something toward which we work that perhaps we cannot completely achieve any more than we can guarantee that every child in every school is going to have a superlative teacher. But we work towards that, and everything we do is to try to get nearer that goal. I think we've accomplished a good deal, but and if out of 70,000 children, it's not that anymore, 65,000 children in the Pittsburgh schools, we can make sure that half of them have an interracial experience. We've just brought up that many more people who in the next generation will be less prejudiced. But I think we've got to be careful. I think in some ways we're asking a little too much of people. We're upper middle class white people would resent having their children suddenly dumped into a very poor, low-achieving white school. But if they object to doing that with a black group, where you put the wrong interpretation on it. But you've still got to make sure that they have some kind of exposure, and as far as that goes, exposure to people of less cultural quality is also part of education. But if you're asking them to accept everything at once, there's enough prejudice between people of equal education, or has been. And if we can overcome that, we've done something. It's perhaps one of the great things that the service on the school board has done for me, is this constant association with black people of education and quality, and the sense that they can achieve just as much, given the chance.
As you look back, what would you say were the major accomplishments made by the school board?
In the maintenance, by and large, of a professional staff of integrity. In recent years, we've made considerable progress on integration, but particularly on the staff level, on the administrative level. Our percentage of teachers doesn't equal the percentage of students, but it's been coming up steadily. And one has to remember that in these days, when every occupation is trying to integrate, there is a fiercer competition for the black professional than there is anywhere else. You try to get a teacher and go to a college in the senior year and try to interview competent blacks, you've got the U.S. government and U.S. Steel and everybody else lined up behind you trying to get that same person, because there hasn't been enough time to develop a large pool of black professionals, and they can pick and choose better than anybody else at the moment. But our administrative staff, principals, central administration, is extraordinarily well integrated with people of very high quality. And I think that's been one of our real accomplishments. When you have a black principal at Taylor Overdice whom children respect, you are doing just as much, if not more, to break down prejudice than you are having them sit next to a black youngster. Only the future will tell what Bill Fisher has accomplished. I think we've I think one of the great accomplishments in recent years has been a great development in the whole climate of freedom of instruction, freedom of learning, the individualization of instruction, the general recognition that you can't draw up a course of study and mold everybody into it, and that you need a much more freedom than has ever been in the system, that it isn't what is being taught the third week of November.